It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, House Republicans are looking to cut $5.5 trillion in federal spending over the next 10 years. We'll get the latest from Washington.
But first, were you among the many Wisconsinites stepping outside last night to catch a rare glimpse of the Northern Lights? They were seen as far south as Madison for the first time in about a decade after a surprise solar storm hit peak levels and kicked off a kind of global aurora watching craze last night in both hemispheres.
Astronomers say strong solar activity caused the aurora borealis to be brighter than usual, but what exactly is happening in space to bring bright green lights to the northern horizon?
To learn more, we turn to Chris Janssen. He's the planetarium director at the Wausau School District. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So what happened last night with all the solar activity to create this aurora craze last night?
Well, the sun basically spit in our general direction with a solar flare yesterday. But the particles that it ejected are high-energy particles that kind of escape the magnetic field, mostly electrons. And those particles come at us at extremely high velocities, charged, subject to magnetic fields. Most of the particles are gently deflected away thanks to our magnetic north and south pole. However, some of those particles are funneled down towards the poles because of they are charged particle. And they strike the atmosphere, which then gives like a fluorescing effect, just like a light bulb.
And what was the deal with this particular solar storm and aurora that made it such a big deal?
Well, the sun is a little bit unpredictable. We understand quite a bit about it. The Solar Dynamics Observatory this last 10 years has really given us a great eye on it. But we really can't predict these particular storms. And so the material that's ejected just happened to be a particularly large coronal mass ejection, and it happened to be aimed right at us, or close to us.
I was watching Twitter pretty closely last night, trying to see if I should head out in my car, which eventually I did, and people were saying this was a solar storm, the likes of which we hadn't seen in a decade.
Yeah, I was looking at the numbers all last night, and then this morning as well, and there's something called the KP Index, which kind of can tell you which latitudes these things can be seen, and even now, as we talk, the levels, the KP index, according to NOAA's website, is at 6, which is here in central Wisconsin. It's not quite down by Madison, but central and northern Wisconsin right now, if there was no daylight, we might be able to see something. We'll have to see what happens over the next 5 or 6 hours as it gets dark.
So there is another chance for people to see this maybe tonight if this hangs on.
Yes. Yeah. It is reduced. Last night, actually, it turns out the 8 or 9 o'clock p.m. people were the ones who got to see stuff. Right after maybe, 9 o'clock or so, things dropped very quickly from like KP index of 8, which would reach down by Madison, maybe even into Chicago. And then right after about 9 o'clock or so, things dropped significantly back to KP index 5, which is pretty much north of Wausau.
Okay, I'm so jealous of those people who got out there early. I got out there at around 10:30 and didn't see anything. But for those people who were lucky enough, and I saw all these pictures from around the world, really, what did they see?
Well, the biggest thing is the reports, and everyone has seen probably pictures of Northern Lights, is this kind of undulating curtain of light with spikes, and it just changes. It's constantly in motion. It's slow motion, kind of like watching a fish tank or something, you know, very, very slow. Mostly greens caused by oxygen. This particular storm was so extreme that those particles were really penetrating deep into the atmosphere, and so we're actually starting to see some reactions with nitrogen and giving us the reds and the pinks. There was a picture I saw over in Sweden, northern Sweden, just unbelievable. There's a photographer there who was quoted as saying he's never seen anything like this with the reds and the pinks.
Now, if we lived, say, near the North Pole, would we see Northern Lights all the time, or is it even rare that far north?
Actually, there is a kind of a donut shape. They call it like an oval that surrounds the magnetic North Pole. So actually, right at the North Pole, you're just about as likely to see the Northern Lights as you are, say, where we live in Wisconsin. The prime location would be like the Norway-Sweden latitude, say, 60 degrees north latitude, 50 to 70 degrees north latitude in that donut right around the Earth's magnetic pole. And then I imagine if we were to contact those people, they'd say, oh, yeah, hey, I see them all the time.
Is it normal for it to be a global phenomenon like it was last night? Because it was northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere, and pictures were coming in from all over the world. You know, I wasn't seeing it, but I kind of felt like I was on Twitter. I was seeing Norway and Sweden and New Zealand and Wales and Canada and Illinois and Ohio. It was just everywhere, apparently, but where I was.
Yeah, that was one of the coolest parts, and I love that about modern-day social media, is I got to see pictures of what's coming. You know, it was still daylight here when the alert came out. The sun wasn't even down, and I'm having friends over in Europe, planetarium directors, you know, contacting United States, get ready, get ready. It was really exciting to be a part of something like that.
Now, Veronica hit the road yesterday, or last night, I should say, to try to find this. I only made it as far as the back porch, realized I was going to be blinded by neighborhood lights. I wasn't going to be able to see any kind of northern lights. Did you see it last night, Chris, or have you ever had a firsthand view of the northern lights?
Oh, yeah. When I was younger. Say, not this last solar maximum, but maybe in 2000. They're spectacular. Once you see them, you want to see them again. Mm. And it's worth it. You know, like, you know, I'm fairly new father, and so you're right. You step out onto the deck and you kind of look out, and, oh, it's a little cold, and, you know, everyone's asleep, and I don't want to bother people, but there's still always that drive to get in the car and drive as far as you need to. Because they are so fantastically beautiful. Once you see them, you just never quite forget them. I did get a report from a local, we have a planetarium newsletter, so I sent out an alert yesterday, and I got a report back that, you know, she took her daughter out north of Wausau here, and for the first time, her daughter got to see the northern lights, and she could barely sleep, I guess, last night. So I got
so
that
cool.
to weigh on me today.
And did we in Wisconsin get those bright colors, those reds and pinks that other people were getting?
I heard reports of some pinks. They were pretty light. By the time, you know, 9 o'clock was coming, 8 o'clock, by the time the astronomical twilight had set in, you know, we were already on the way down from the KP index. So by that point, the pinks and reds were fairly benign. You'd have to be up north, say Tomahawk, or up, you know, by the big lake to really start seeing some of those colors.
Veronica mentioned seeing Twitter posts from New Zealand. Do they have the Southern Lights? Are they called the Southern Lights down there?
They are. It's Aurora Borealis, which is the Northern Lights, and then those are called Aurora Australis. And it was predicted when we were first discovering what they were that since you have a magnetic pole, there's no such thing in the universe as a monopole. If you have a North Pole, you must, according to the laws of physics, have a South Pole, and they are equal in strength. So if you are having these particles come in and strike the North Pole, it is then predicted you will have the same effect at the South Pole. And so sure enough, now in the age of satellites, people can watch live the donut-shaped effect of this high-energy particle impact is almost identical on both the North and South Pole.
So the slightly annoying thing about the Northern Lights is that you never really know when they're going to hit, and so you end up like me driving around in your car randomly for hours. But how can we maximize our chances of actually seeing them?
Yes. It used to be you'd have a network of phone, or phone network of friends, and we'd all call each other, you know. And that still is very powerful. You know, if it's even 2 in the morning, we have rules for each other, you know. Like, if you see them any time of the day, you call. You know, some people say that, and some people say, no, if it's after 2, don't even bother. But nowadays, we have smartphone technologies, and there are some devices, and I'll be platform, you know, non-discriminant here, but both Android and Apple, if you were to just search Aurora, you know, you can get many free apps that will actually alert you when the KP index reaches a certain point, and it will actually beep at you if you set your notifications as such. For I think that maybe $2 or a couple of dollars for these apps, you can have it do more than just alert you. You know, it can do forecasting, and so nowadays my best suggestion for folks who really want to see this is get hooked up with some type of tablet app or smartphone app. Most people have some type of tablet or something that would just actually alert you or page you when it's time to get out.
And Chris, a little bit cloudy, at least here in Madison. Are you going to go out and try to see if there's any aurora going on tonight?
Definitely. I'll be watching this KP index. And I was like you. I missed the 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock lights. I'm thinking, I was looking at the NOAA's website, and I said, oh, it's really going to punch hard at, you know, between 11 and 2 a.m. That's what the forecast says. And just like a bad luck clock, the KP just dropped like a rock from like 8 down to 5 right at about 9 o'clock. So I'll be going out tonight again, yes.
I feel your pain, but I don't know if I'm going to be out there with you again. Well, Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. It was fun.
We've been speaking with Chris Janssen, Planetarium Director for the Wausau School District, telling us about the science behind last night's aurora borealis seen in both hemispheres from Norway to New Zealand. Republicans in Congress have released their budget proposals, with the House proposing a $5.5 trillion spending cut over the next decade. Most Republicans agree on items like not raising taxes and overhauling entitlements, but defense spending might be a sticking point.
USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer joins us now. He's with us every Wednesday at this time with the latest from Washington. Paul, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. Well, let's start with the story, not the big budget story. We'll get to that in a minute. But this story you've been following about Representative Aaron Schock from Illinois, you've been covering it since it broke. Your thoughts when you heard the news that he's resigning?
Yeah, well, not a major surprise. We figured pretty early on in this one that sooner or later he was going to have to step down, because it was just becoming a frenzy of stories, and every single one of them turned up something either odd or strange or possibly a violation of the rules or even illegal. So he was spending money on flights that he wasn't supposed to be allowed to take. Somebody discovered that he was billing taxpayers for more mileage reimbursement than he could have possibly driven. He used taxpayer money to fly to a Chicago Bears game. He was taking his staff to concerts. I mean, it's just, you know, after a while, they're like, okay, this is going to get old pretty soon, and sooner or later he's going to have to go. And sure enough, yesterday he said he'll be leaving at the end of the month.
And it all started with expensive office furniture based on Downton Abbey models.
Right. Well, this is the kicker of this story, and I just actually posted a column on this today, that, you know, it started with a reporter for the Washington Post going and looking at his office, his newly renovated office, going, wow, this is kind of wacky. And someone saying, yeah, it's a Downton Abbey-themed office. And the communications director in the office saying, no, wait, don't write about the office. There's nothing to see here. And that got all of our antenna up, like, well, what do you mean there's nothing to see here? And so several of our news organizations started digging into what the spending was. I discovered that he'd paid for marble countertops and hardwood floors at another congressional office. Somebody else discovered, you know, some of these other flights that were odd. I mean, it sort of went downhill from there. And now he's basically just thrown in the towel and said, I'm leaving. Now, that doesn't mean that he's off the hook if he's done anything illegal. We don't know if some of these, you know, reimbursements are actually against the law, if some of the flights are actually against the law. Somebody could still pursue him in court. We will see if the feds are interested in doing that.
You know, it seems really old school to me. It seems like every decade or two there's some weird misappropriation congressional thing going on. This is not a new thing in a way, is it?
No, and they never seem to learn. I mean, you know, there are simply rules in place for members of Congress that I think they forget sometimes, that all of this money, whether it's campaign money or the official taxpayer account or the super PAC money, whatever it is, it's not really yours. You can't just decide to spend it on yourself and go, you know, get a mani-pedi or whatever it is. You know, there are rules, and it has to be very carefully managed. And once you start to forget that and start to look at it all as just sort of your playground, you are in deep, deep, deep trouble.
All right. Well, let's turn to some bigger money items now. Budgets. Republicans in Congress, each chamber laying out their proposals. House yesterday, Senate today. Anything big, striking, surprising, first of all, Paul?
You know, I think the interesting thing on this whole budget story is it's going to be a dispute between Republicans where the Democrats don't matter. The real gist of it, I don't know how surprising it is, but the real sort of nugget here is that House Republicans get a chance finally to pass their long-awaited budget blueprint that would convert Medicare from a simple entitlement program to a kind of government support program that would help people pay for their own insurance. That's something that they were never able to get through a Democratic Senate. Well, now they got a Republican Senate, and lo and behold, the Republican Senate's not sure they want to do that either. So that's going to be a really interesting showdown.
So when people start talking about changing the way Medicare works or Social Security or whatever program you want to talk about, people are worried about the accusation of privatizing whatever thing it is. Is that holding some Republicans in the House or especially the Senate back from enthusiastically tackling this?
Well, keep in mind, if you are a Republican senator, in a state with an awful lot of retirees and you're going to run for re-election. I think you guys have one of those. Is that not correct?
That is correct.
So if you're Senator Johnson or if you are Pat Toomey, a Republican senator from Pennsylvania, it's going to be something you're going to have to face in the campaign that people are going to say, you voted to either privatize Medicare or take away my Medicare, however you want to phrase it. And it's a difficult issue. I mean, it's something that they are very sensitive about. And in the Senate, they do not do that at the moment. They're going to have to sit down with the House Republicans and figure out how they're going to pass something that both sides can agree on.
So this is an issue that you're saying on the Senate budget side, they don't do this voucher, this pay-in program
nope.
that the House is talking about.
No, they don't do it yet. I mean, they don't have it in the bill the Senate introduced today. Now, again, if Republicans want to pass a budget, and they, by the way, that is a very important agenda item for them to say that, to prove that they can govern, the House and the Senate Republicans are going to have to agree on which path they take. Do they so-called privatize Medicare? Do they create this voucher program? Or do they not? And at the moment, Senate Republicans are on the not side, and House Republicans are on the do side, and that is going to be interesting.
Well, another potential room for disagreement among Republicans, it seems like, has to do with defense spending. We're seeing more hawkish Republicans, the John McCains of the world, wanting to boost spending. Us libertarian-leaning Republicans say we want to cut all spending, including defense spending. So what's that shaping up like?
Well, again, the same deal. That part of the way you do this, you all remember, I'm sure, the conversation about sequestration, where they set these across-the-board budget cut targets for everybody, including the Defense Department. Now, particularly Republicans would like to get out from under those cuts for defense spending. Well, how do you do that without blowing a hole in the deficit, raising the deficit further? And in the House, they've done it by essentially sticking a bunch of defense spending in a separate account that doesn't count for bookkeeping reasons. It's a war funding account. And the Republicans in the Senate don't think that's such a good idea. You shouldn't be monkeying with a, you know, war funding account. So that's, again, an issue where Republicans in the House and the Republicans in the Senate are not on the same page, and they're going to have to figure out how to sort this out if they plan to pass a budget. Now, there are some other things they do agree on, right? I mean, they both sides have repeals of Obamacare in these budget agreements. Both the sides have, you know, rolling back a bunch of regulations and cutting taxes and reducing spending. So there's a lot to agree on here for the Republicans, but they're going to have to work out some of these details.
All right, so they work out the details, say they agree on to disagree, come up with a plan, pass it maybe by April 15th, then what? It goes to President Obama, so does this, can't he just veto the whole thing?
No, he cannot.
In fact,
the nice thing about budget resolutions is these are not law, they're resolutions. So it does not require a filibuster. Congress can do this by themselves. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, it is, they're not binding on anything. All they do is set budget targets for Congress to spend the money. So ultimately, there's a question about whether these things mean anything other than symbolism. They certainly mean that, if nothing else, that they are declaring the official policy of Congress on budget matters, even though they're not actually laws.
Well, I want to turn to one international issue that became a congressional issue recently. Israeli elections. Looks like Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will continue to be the prime minister there. Some new coalition building going on. Tight race. He came to Congress a little while back. There's a lot of speculation. Was this an election stunt for him? Would it help him or hurt him? Did that trip end up meaning much from the American perspective as we thought it might?
You know, it's an interesting question to see what, I mean, 2 weeks ago it was a really big deal. It was the Prime Minister of Israel kind of thumbing his nose at the President of the United States and giving a speech that was intended to embolden the opponents of the president. Who knows? I mean, in 3 weeks, will we have moved on? I don't know. I mean, I think the issue will now become when and if U.S. Congress takes up a bill on Iran sanctions and basically tries to repudiate the Obama administration's negotiations with Iran over their nuclear program. That's when this matters. But at this point, I think Netanyahu's role and his appearance here kind of fades. And the next question is, when can Obama and Netanyahu sit down together, shake hands, and agree on something and start rebuilding that relationship internationally?
And do you think Congress wants to be a part of that that handshake meeting, that they want to have some kind of say in how that goes down?
Probably not, but they definitely want to be involved in this negotiation with Iraq, with Iran. Sorry, there's, you know, is a real concern amongst the hawks, not only the Republicans, mostly Republicans, about the administration being involved in discussions with Iran, that it's going to give away too much without getting any real benefit in return. That's what Netanyahu was saying. That's why the Republicans invited him here. And we'll see if Congress tries to essentially intercede in that process.
Paul, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time with the latest from the nation's capital. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. There's growing fallout from last week's controversy over a fraternity at the University of Oklahoma. A video was leaked showing fraternity members doing a racist chant referencing lynching and in derogatory language stating that the fraternity would never include African Americans.
The university has since banned that fraternity chapter and expelled two students involved. Today, the national fraternity organization, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, apologized, announced a nationwide review of its chapters, along with a new diversity initiative.
Our next guest says this isn't just a story about one fraternity chapter or even about fraternities in general. In his research, he spent a lot of time talking to young white men in higher education, and he says invisible racism is common on our nation's campuses.
Nolan Cabrera joins us now. He's an assistant professor in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona. Nolan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm going to start with the offending language in this video that got the fraternity chapter of Sigma Alpha Epsilon, or SAE, closed. I'm going to say N-word over the original language. There will never be an N-word
that.
SAE. You can hang them from a tree, but they'll never sign with me. There will never be an N-word SAE. So, Nolan, based on your research, are you surprised to hear this from a group of white college students?
Not at all. It's actually more common than not in the white men who I interview to have them either hear or even say the N-word on a very regular basis. And I think what's most troubling for me is that they don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's almost a word that they use for shock value, something to play with, kind of the way that kindergartners are obsessed with fecal matter. It's sort of that this is the next generation of that. And unfortunately, what they completely disregard in that process is that this word is specifically meant to demean, dehumanize, and they have no sense of the social context or the power of the term, so they just play around with it, and it's very, very common around college campuses.
Now, there have been other fraternity scandals in the news lately, a new one in Pennsylvania over a gender issue there, a fraternity banned here in Wisconsin over hazing. So this story has been viewed a lot through the lens of fraternities gone wrong. But is this something wider than just a fraternity story, Nolan?
There's two different things. On the one hand, no, this isn't fraternities gone wrong. This is fraternities getting caught. This is a predictable outcome of the fraternity structure, where there's minimal accountability, minimal method diversity, and in many respects, these are only the ones that are floating to the surface. On the other hand, you are correct that this isn't just a fraternity issue in the sense that, you know, only maybe about 10 to 12% of the students I interview actually have some sort of fraternity affiliation. And in many respects, the colloquial use of the N-word and just playing with it in what I view are completely inappropriate ways is rampant. It's just, and it's not just a fraternity issue. But what it is it's an issue that exists when white people, in general, white men in particular, have the ability to exist in environments where they don't have people of color around them, when they don't have black people around them. And really, that's sort of the biggest issue, that in many respects, students of color are blamed for campus self-segregation, and in many respects, it's actually white people who are doing the greatest segregating.
Now, in your research, you've mentioned you talk to young white men, in particular on campuses. How do you get them to frankly express their views on race?
They don't have to, when they're talking to me, and as my department head says, I am obviously a person of color, and I even identify myself as such at the beginning of the interviews. But these are interviews where you know, I'm reaching out to them and saying, you can express your views confidentially. You can talk to me, and whatever you say, that's, you know, as long as it's representative of your views, that's okay. Not okay in a moral sense, but, you know, that's what the interview should be able to do. And they take that as license to just say whatever on their mind. There's no accountability in my interviews because, you know, I have no power over them. And also what I've been finding is that a lot of these young men, they feel very censored regarding issues of race. Now, there's nothing they can specifically point to. It's not like someone called them out in a class. They just feel like their views aren't valued. So they have these really strong views of race and racism, but they just never say them. So it almost becomes sort of a type of racial therapy. Like they just want to cathartically get it out of their system.
Now, you've talked about it, and I think your dissertation was titled Invisible Racism. This kind of racism, and this is a tough judgment maybe, but is this conscious, intentional bias against people of a different race, or is this a matter of unquestioned assumptions that everybody else is doing, so people just kind of do it without thinking about it?
That distinction for me is actually completely irrelevant in the respect that if somebody comes up to a black kid and uses the N-word, or uses the N-word and it gets caught the way that it did in SAE, the effect on the kid is still the same. The effect on the student is still the same, whether you intended to or not. And I think we actually unintentionally derail the really important racial conversations that we need to have because we're constantly looking for intentionality. And in many respects, it allows people to say racist things and do racist actions and then say, but it really wasn't racist because I didn't intend to offend. And my point is that I'm not concerned with what you intended to do. It's what you did do that's the most important part.
So apart from what we've heard in this Oklahoma story, what kind of things have you heard from these young, white, mostly male students? What are their views on race? What kind of attitudes and behaviors that do they tell you about?
My goodness, that's an extremely in-depth conversation, so I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest version. in many respects, they tend to exist in very racially homogenous environments. Coming to college, despite the diversity of a lot of the campuses that they attend, they don't necessarily interact across race except for very superficial ways. When issues of race do come up, it tends to very much be about how they perceive themselves to be victimized. They see themselves, in particular the combination of being white and male, as excluding them from participation in or for being competitive for scholarships. I almost didn't get into this school because of affirmative action, because less qualified white women and minorities got in ahead of me. And there's this very, very pertinent discourse of reverse racism, which lacks any empirical foundation, but they really honestly do feel that way. And that's in addition to some just very overtly racist things that they do and say in their daily lives, racial joking, using the N-word. But again, they do it behind closed doors because they come from a general ideological orientation that, well, minorities are overly sensitive on issues of race, so I don't want it to be misconstrued. They don't think that they're doing anything wrong, and actually kind of challenge that notion. I think they really deep down do know they're doing something wrong, which is because if they didn't, they would do it out in public, but they don't. They do it behind closed doors, or what Peek and Fagan refer to as backstage racism.
So I'll ask you another huge, complicated question. How do we start changing that conversation? How do we get the people we're talking about to talk openly and maybe explore these attitudes a little more deeply?
Well, the big thing that we need to understand is that diversity initiatives in higher education cannot be piecemeal. All too often, a campus or university will increase the proportions of students of color on campus and say, okay, cool, we've done our diversity work. When in fact, it's multifaceted, it's multi-pronged, and most importantly, they need to be in engaged as a concerted effort. So, you know, you need increasing the proportion of students of color on campus is important. But then you need to foster areas like intergroup dialogues where people can have meaningful cross-racial interactions and have these deeper discussions across race. You need to embed it into diversity into the overall structure of the institution. Is it part of the accountability structure for administrators? Is it part of the assessment of the efficacy of the overall institution? Or is it going to be the way we usually talk about diversity, as kind of a convenient little add-on if we think about it, or if we actually want to do something about it? It would be cute if we could engage diversity. Or do we consider diversity to be sort of at the core, at the crux of the education that we're doing?
Now, in this particular instance in Oklahoma, the university's response banning this fraternity, the national fraternity's response to close down this chapter, a couple of students expelled by the university. What do you make of the particular response in this instance?
Okay. Well, there's a couple of different issues going on. One, the open condemnation of the fraternity in many respects is sort of a way of trying to make it seem like it's an isolated incident, or that it doesn't have larger ramifications. I believe the terminology the University of Oklahoma president used was that we have a zero tolerance policy for racism in Oklahoma, which is, if you took that out to its logical extension, it holds no weight. It's no, that you have a zero tolerance policy for overt instances of racism that get caught on tape, put on YouTube, and then embarrass the institution on the national media. Having said that, in student affairs work around colleges and universities, there's constantly this mantra that, we need to make these into teachable moments. Teachable moments are important for the moral and individual development of students on campus. But my problem with that, and specifically in instances that are so egregious as this one, is that the students knew what they were doing was wrong. It would be really hard to find people who don't necessarily think that what they did was wrong. And they did it anyway. And for me, that sort of moves the discussion beyond a teachable moment. It's an instance where, what are you going to teach them? In this, and so in some respects, it becomes more of a teachable moment for the institution as a whole. That is, that don't do this as a teachable moment to the other fraternities and sororities and even just the general campus community.
We're talking to Nolan Cabrera from the University of Arizona about what he calls invisible racism in higher education, racism that plays out behind the scenes, behind closed doors, when no one's watching or when no one's thought to be watching, with last week's fraternity scandal in Oklahoma as a recent example.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this in your life, in higher education or elsewhere? Do people, do you think, feel comfortable using racially charged language when they're not in the public eye? And how do you react to that if you're present? What do you think about it? What do you think is the appropriate response to this incident in Oklahoma? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation about invisible racism, racially charged language behind the scenes when people are out of the public eye. And this follows last week's leak of a video showing members of an Oklahoma fraternity performing a chant talking about keeping African Americans out of their organization.
Nolan Cabrera from the University of Arizona stays with us. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this story from Oklahoma? What was your reaction? What do you think the response should be? And do you think there's a lot of behind closed doors expression of racially charged attitudes, language, behavior? Have you encountered it yourself? Call now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Donna on the line in Burlington. Donna, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'd like to say I have been following the story somewhat, and I wasn't surprised. But I added my name to the Facebook page of the president of the university who had decided to disband the fraternity. I was very happy to hear that. I was also very happy to hear that I finally have a name, Invisible Racism, because when all the stuff came out about Ferguson and New York, there would be a lot of people making comments on threads. And a lot of the white people I saw made claims that racism doesn't exist. Most of these people were people who came from white communities. As a white person, though, I said, when I get behind closed doors, I live in an all-white community or almost all-white, and I said when people think no one else is around except for white people that they know, they feel it's okay to express themselves. And I said, I know that racism is alive and well because I hear it behind closed doors when nobody thinks it matters.
Donna, thank you so much for that call. Nolan Cabrera, do you think that Donna's story is common around the country?
It's absolutely common throughout the country. That one a big problem why these racial issues continue to persist is that we're not able to have a meaningful conversation about it because there's such a persistent denial that racism is at all an issue. And so instead of actually saying, let's figure out strategies to meaningfully engage it, we instead are even debating, which is, in my opinion, an asinine debate as to whether or not racism still exists. And it's something that people are continually, you know, let's try to move beyond it, let's try to move beyond it. And the more that we try to move beyond it instead of meaningfully engage it, the worse these problems get in the process. And, you know, and Donna's comment about, you know, being a white person and speaking out on these issues is actually critically important because she has access to these areas where a lot of people of color don't. And so in many respects, it becomes even of greater importance for people like her to engage these issues, to speak out on these issues, and to disrupt these behind-closed-door racism that occurs on a very regular basis.
Donna, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Berhat in Milwaukee. Berhat, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I was listening to the show, and I remember even when I first heard that, you know, this tape, it's not very surprising. If you ever go online, especially if you play online video games, it's, like, prevalent for, you know, white males to either, you know, just directly say, you know, blatantly racist things, or they'll have a character who has a darker complexion, and they'll name them, or name her, like, Kanisha or something, and then say that, you know, she's a hood chick or she's a welfare queen. It's so prevalent, like online in different games, on Xbox Live. It's surprising that, you know, people even find it surprising.
Berhat, thanks for the call. Nolan, your thoughts?
There were two really important issues that Bernhard just brought up. One is that on the online community, it becomes a really important way for this racism to manifest because even though you have a virtual contact with somebody, you don't actually have a contact with a person. And so in many respects, it's those instances where our worst selves come out, our deepest, darkest selves come out. And it's so... it's so prevalent, and we don't even consider that because so much of it we talk about is interpersonal. But in many respects, those are the areas where it's manifests so dramatically. And I the second part is just that, yeah, it's most surprising that it is surprising. I guess is sort of the best way that I can talk about it. That I'm most surprised by how surprised people were that these issues came up, and it actually speaks to how we haven't engaged race and how we're not continuing to engage it in a meaningful way moving ahead.
Berhat, thanks a lot for calling in. We'll go next to Margaret with us in Milwaukee. Margaret, hi.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say I think that was deplorable what those students were doing and the fashion that they were doing it was very disrespectful. But yet what concerns me is the fact that when it's a white person using the N-word, everything breaks loose. It's awful, which it is. But yet there are many, many blacks in the black community, younger people, I think I've heard more than others, that also use the black word, even talking to each other. But yet nothing's made of that. I'm wondering, is it starting to become a double standard where it's okay for their own community to be using that, but not the other community?
Margaret, thanks for bringing that up. Nolan, what do you think of that?
This is a very, very common debate that comes up, and I really think it's an issue of false equivalency. I think back when I was a kid that, you know, it's all right for me to pick on my little sister, but anybody else does, that's not okay. And the difference between a black person using the N-word and white people using the N-word is that fundamentally white people can't understand what it is to be dehumanized, to be degraded, to have their life chances, to have their life opportunities limited as a result of systemic racism.
And to have this term out there as one component of that, in particular to dehumanize people, white people simply can never understand what that is. There's no equivalent terminology for white people, period. And so in many respects, what's happening is you're having white students playing with a terminology whose true meaning, and by true meaning I mean if you actually have to feel and experience its impact, they're never going to understand. And then from an historical perspective, marginalized groups have consistently taken the terms that have been meant to dehumanize them and try to co-opt them and turn them around so that it takes a little bit of the sting out of it. A classic example in the LGBTQ community is the term queer and how it's been flipped on its head. But in many respects, it's up to those communities themselves to be able to navigate that, to negotiate that, because they're the ones who actually understand what it is to be degraded in that way via those terminologies. It's no part, really the only reservation that I have about black youth using the term is that socially it becomes licensed for white people to use it. And so that's why I would hope that they wouldn't do it. But if they're trying to use it as a way of taking the sting out of the term, it's a completely different issue altogether.
Nolan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It's a good conversation.
That's Nolan Cabrera. He's an assistant professor in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona, talking about the recent scandal over racist chants at a now banned fraternity in Oklahoma. Lori Skelton is back with us in a couple days for this week's edition of Food Friday, and it's the day of the Great American Meat Out, an effort to get people to try eating vegetarian meals, at least every now and again. So Lori's going to focus on meatless cooking and alternatives to meat.
And to help prepare, she asked us to pass along a question to you. If you're a meat eater and you don't like meatless dishes, what is it that you think is missing when there's no meat in the recipe? What objections would she have to overcome to get you to enjoy a vegetarian meal? And you can share your answer, your thoughts, over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And on the other hand, if you have a favorite vegetarian meal, something without meat, we'd love to hear about that too. Tell us what it is and what makes it work for you. Do that at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. You know, Lori's pretty good at coming up with meatless stuff. In that big chili show we did.
And the big hit was the veggie chili.
Veggie chili, yeah. I mean, there's some meat options, definitely. And both of us are pretty flexible. We'll both eat meat, some kinds.
Flexitarian. Yeah.
But I like fake meat products. I like a lot of veggie dishes. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to this. Looking forward to some good ideas from you.
Yeah, it should be an interesting one. I think there's a move, at least among, you know, some diet watchers, to move people away from eating so much meat. So we'll see what Lori's got for us.